I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Do you happen to know anybody who ever attended a séance? My grandmother did. She did it as a total skeptic, I should say, and by very clever stratagem, she exposed the séance's medium as a complete fraud. It's really quite a story, and she told it to me many years ago. But her experience happened just a century ago in the years following World War II. We're going to go back to time well before that. Our next guest has stories to tell about seances that she has researched, and these stories come from even decades before my grandmother's time. Her stories of spiritualism, our guests, go back to the inception of the movement and then into the heyday of it all, smack dab in the middle of the Victorian era. And in a very curious way, these stories intersect with women's suffrage and increasing political sway for women in society. I'm just going to say it right out. Some of the things you're about to hear are wacky, and I mean that in the best possible way, except when it comes to the fraudulent stuff. Emily Midorikawa joins with us now. Midorikawa teaches at the New York University London campus and is author of Out of the Shadows, Six Visionary Victorian Women in Search of a Public Voice. Emily, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
So I want to begin just with the question. I've succeeded, I think, in signaling that seances and mediums to me are just so much bunk. And your interest in spiritualism kind of strikes me as less an interest in how shall I say this? You know, any of the veracity, the credibility of it. I mean, where do you start from?
I'm interested in spiritualism, and particularly 19th century spiritualism, really as a historical movement, as a cultural phenomenon of the 19th century. I'm not a spiritualist myself, but I think there's a great deal of interest in this subject matter. It's actually something that I became aware of through research that I was doing for a previous book. My last book was on female literary friendship, so completely different topic. But I was also looking at 19th century letters, specifically letters by Harriet Beecher Stowe to George Eliot. And it's a subject that comes up in their letters. And I became interested in it through reading those letters. And then once I stopped researching that book, got it written, sent off to the publishers, I thought, oh, I'll return to that source material and see what I can find. And thankfully, I found quite a lot, which opened up doors to all sorts of other areas of, yes, like you say, sometimes slightly wacky sources, interesting research materials. And that's really how the book was born.
Well, from the beginning of the movement, spiritualism, would you say that women were more prominent than men as participants?
So there were men who were active within the spiritualism movement, both as psychic mediums and, you know, people who conducted seances and also participants. But I think it was a movement that was particularly welcoming to women in terms of women who actually ran seances. This was actually a relatively rare arena in which women could take control of a room. And by a room, sometimes, you know, you're not talking about a small number of people huddled in the darkness around a table. I mean, obviously there was that side of it, but it could be taking control of a whole auditorium, speaking to vast numbers of people sometimes, or demonstrating your powers or supposed powers to vast numbers of people. And I think, you know, in the 19th century, obviously, when we think about that historical period, it's not a period in which women tended to hold positions of authority, positions of public office. So it's quite a rare opportunity for women to take control of rooms and to kind of have their voices heard. And this made it appealing both for people who were taking a more leadership-like role and also people who just enjoyed attending seances and perhaps, you know, getting out and about in a way that they wouldn't normally be able to in their ordinary life.
We're going to get to some names and tell some stories of very specific individuals, some prominent women in the spiritualism movement. But I think just to recap here, I kind of hear you saying this is a time when women did not have much to say about what goes on in society. And this was an avenue for them. This was a place where they could seize some power over an audience.
Yes, and I think that's particularly the case with, well, two of the individuals that I've written about in the book. One of them, Emma Harding Britton, was what was known as a trance lecturer. By that, I mean she would get up on a stage and she would give actually sometimes quite controversial speeches, you know, perhaps about the need for women's suffrage or the need to abolish slavery, which obviously wasn't popular in all parts of the United States at the time, and other topics that were considered to be somewhat unladylike for a woman to be talking about. And what she was saying was made somewhat more palatable by the fact that she presented herself as not speaking her own words. She said that she was channeling the words of dead spirits, and they were usually male spirits that she was channeling. And so in a way that allowed her the chance to speak about quite controversial topics, but to abdicate some responsibility, I think, by presenting herself, or perhaps it was a genuine belief that she was speaking the words of male spirits who had long departed and couldn't be called into question in the same way as she would, perhaps, as a woman.
You know, I hear a smile in your voice and I'm chuckling inside, because what you're actually saying here is that the men of that day didn't want to hear from women, not even dead women, the ghosts. And if you're going to hear from a ghost, it better be a man, and I'll take it through a woman if she's channeling it.
Yes, I think that obviously not everyone had that view, but I think that was quite a popular view at the time. And it did sort of, allow her some kind of freedom that perhaps she wouldn't have had in other circumstances.
Well, you've mentioned Emma Harding Britton. And before we get to her or other mediums, let's go back to the inception. There was a group of girls, last name Fox, and they had a conspicuous part in ushering in this era.
Yes. So obviously for centuries before the mid-19th century, there were people who believed that the living had the power to contact the dead. But the spiritualist movement itself, most people point its beginnings to a specific date, actually, in 1848, and a specific place as well, the hamlet of Hydesville in rural New York State. And you're right, there were two girls living there called Maggie and Kate Fox, who were about 11 and 14 years old at the time. And one evening, their local community was completely gripped by excitement, because within the Fox family's house, there were noises being heard, noises like knocking sounds, which the family had become convinced were communications from beyond the grave. Specifically, it was eventually found by questioning this unseen spirit, that it was supposedly a dead man who had been buried in the cellar underneath that building. Well, of course, this caused a huge amount of excitement in that small community, and word soon spread to the villages and towns outside of this small community. But I think, you know, really, this could have stayed as a local story. It obviously very interesting, and you know, something that people can debate a great deal if they think there's perhaps a spirit that's taken residence within a particular house within the place that you live. But I think it could have stayed as a relatively local matter if the sister's older sibling, Leah Fox, who was quite a bit older than her two younger sisters, hadn't got involved. But she took Kate and Maggie eventually to stay with her in the city of Rochester, which was about, well, still is obviously about 40 miles away from Hydesville. And she introduced them to various influential local figures, particularly individuals who were quite interested, again, in social reform, abolitionism, women's suffrage and the like. They were quite taken with what the Fox sisters seemed to be managing to manifest around themselves. And they helped the Fox sisters to organize a public demonstration of their talents at communicating with the dead. This led to a big public tour, which saw them finally landing in New York City, where they really became kind of the talk of the town. Everyone wanted to go and see the Fox sisters and find out, you know, about these mysterious knocking sounds that always seemed to accompany them. And Yeah, so for a while they were a real kind of press sensation, and things were looking very good for them. I think there was a flip side to all this attention, though. They became very overworked. I think particularly the younger sisters, Kate and Maggie, who we've got to remember were still really just girls, very young women at the time. It really started to take a toll on them, you know, the pressure of having to sort of perform, if you like, or to always have the spirits, you know, turn up at seances. When people paid to, you know, to come and see them, they wanted to, you know, feel like they were getting their money's worth. And, you know, eventually this led to various issues on their part. You know, they both became alcoholics. They both became very, very resentful eventually of their sister Leah's part in sort of kicking off this huge phenomenon, which is what they became.
I'm really glad you said the word money, because you got to follow the money in a story like this. Somebody is profiteering here. It sounds very exploitative.
Yes. I mean, so the later on in life, both of the younger Fox sisters said that they didn't make huge amounts of money from this. I mean, they were certainly earning a lot at the height of their fame. They would claim that their older sister, you know, channeled quite a bit of the money away from them. Who knows? Perhaps they also frittered some of it away. You know, I've already mentioned some of their issues with alcoholism. You know, later on in life, some of the things that they said you had to take with a pinch of salt, as it were. But yes, I mean, I think at the time, people who were critical of spiritualism, and specifically not so much the wider movement, but the mediums who were making money out of this was often something that came up. You know, there were people who criticized it because, you know, they just didn't believe that these people were doing what they said they were doing, but also there were people who criticized it because they felt that, you know, many of these mediums were taking advantage of people who had this understandable urge to get in touch with departed loved ones and were sort of profiteering from people's desire to keep that link with people who they'd lost and who they dearly wished to see again or to hear from again.
So I think that we're no longer just talking about Victorian times. I think we're talking about credulous, gullible people through the ages who will empty their pockets, you know, if they're taken in.
Well, I mean, I think there's a whole kind of spectrum of belief with this, you know, the and also with the mediums themselves. Like, there were people who, it's hard to argue, were not lying at least some of the time, because in the case of the Fox sisters, they just told so many different stories about things that it's hard to argue that they were always entirely truthful with their audiences. I think, though, sometimes in the case of some of the people who were involved with this movement, you know, there were certainly genuine believers, certainly amongst participants. But I think even with the mediums themselves, if we think, just going back to Emma Harding Britton, who I mentioned before, I mean, who knows what she felt in her head? We can't know that now. Possibly she, you know, had things that she wanted to say in these speeches, and she felt by presenting herself in this way, you know, channeling the spirit, the voices of dead spirits, and specifically dead male spirits, this was a good way to get her points across. It might have also been that she genuinely was so shocked by some of the things that she was coming out and saying that she the only way to sort of excuse it to herself was to feel that she was channeling something from beyond the grave. You know, perhaps it was really her subconscious speaking. You know, it could have been something like that.
Well, the story of Emma Harding Britton in particular, I think she's a good person to look at to see where this intersection with the political sphere comes in. We're going to talk about her influence in the re-election campaign of Abraham Lincoln, of all people. After a short break, we are visiting with Emily Midorikawa and talking about her book, Out of the Shadows, Six Visionary Victorian Women in Search of a Public Voice. We continue the story after this. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. It's a great pleasure to have Emily Midorikawa with us, talking about her book, Out of the Shadows, Six Visionary Victorian Women in Search of a Public Voice. That public business, let's start talking presidential campaign. How does Emma Harding Britton, a medium of this era, get involved in the public sphere to such an extent that even the campaign of Abraham Lincoln thinks she could be valuable to them?
Well, Emma built up a real reputation, as I said, as a trance lecturer, and people would come and see her speaking, partially because, you know, it's obviously very novel to see somebody channeling the thoughts of dead spirits, or apparently channeling the thoughts of dead spirits when they're talking in public. But the other really novel thing that she was doing at the time was just being a woman on stage speaking out. You know, in a way that had as much of a novelty to it as someone who's supposedly channeling the thoughts of dead spirits. So as time went on, her speeches, they often were still presented as being, you know, the words of dead spirits, but she started to talk about other issues, and sometimes she would appear on stage without actually that kind of preamble, without sort of it being presented as necessarily being the words of the dead. And her speeches, as time went on, became more political. And yes, as you say, yeah, so there was a point when she was approached by people who were involved in the campaign to re-elect Abraham Lincoln, and they felt that, you know, she had become so popular, she would draw such big crowds when she was traveling around, that they actually wanted to get her involved in the campaign, giving speeches. And in fact, after Lincoln's untimely death, after his assassination, she was asked again to give what was called a funeral oration. It wasn't actually at his funeral, but it was a big speech to commemorate his life. And this was actually the first speech to honour Abraham Lincoln that was held in New York City. And so it was a really big thing that she'd been asked to do this. I think particularly striking that she was a woman, and not even an American woman. She was actually of British origin. She'd only arrived in the United States about 10 years prior to that. So it's really, it kind of shows, I think, how the spiritualist movement really could launch someone into the public eye in a way that would have been perhaps unthinkable before.
I don't know why P.T. Barnum comes to mind, but I'm trying to imagine the theater of this, a trance lecture. She goes into a trance while she's giving a public speech. How do you envision this playing out? What do you see?
Yeah, so I think she would have described it more as a half trance. So I don't think she literally would be sort of, you know, kind of swaying around with eyes closed, which I think, you know, perhaps is what most people would perhaps think of seeing someone in a trance. Like, from the records that survive of this, people say she's a very engaging public speaker. So I think she wouldn't necessarily have seemed to be sort of, you know, possessed by spirits in the way we might kind of imagine when she was talking. But certainly at the beginning of many of her talks, it would be, you know, said to the audience that this is what she was going to do. And she was going to give the speech, but also answer questions while still in this semi-trance state.
So the premise is not you've come to hear a public speech, but you've come to hear a public speech from somebody who has very special powers.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Yeah. Well, there is another woman of this era, this Victorian age, who by coincidence is named Victoria, Victoria Woodhull. And tell us a little bit about her, and in particular, some of the pushback that she received.
Yes, so Victoria Woodhull was born in Ohio, again, in quite a small village called Homer, a rural community. And she would later claim to have been someone who experienced visions from a very early age, which was something that Emma Harding Britton also would claim. But she initially became well known in New York City again. She had quite an interesting sort of route to her later fame and fortune. She first became known, a little bit well known locally around her, as someone who was, you could have called her like a spiritual healer. So somebody that you could apparently go to with, you know, a physical ailment, and she would be able to, bring about healing by relatively unconventional methods. She also would claim to have all sorts of other psychic abilities. This eventually saw her living in New York City, as I say, and her powers or apparent powers as someone who could commune with the dead led her into a friendship with Cornelius Vanderbilt, who was obviously one of the wealthiest men in the country at the time. And she became quite well known within financial circles in New York City as someone who could give stock market tips that were supposedly passed to her by dead spirits. So that allowed her to leverage herself into a position of power. Also, her friendship with Vanderbilt also contributed to her getting into this position of power. But eventually she was so successful that her and her sister set up the first female-owned brokerage firm on Wall Street. And they eventually made so much money from that Woodhull decided she would run for the US presidency. This was in the early 1870s. Now, if you think about this at the time, you know, women in general didn't have the vote. So the idea of a woman actually becoming president at the time, really, it was a kind of an audacious ambition that she had. Obviously, we know she didn't succeed. You know, America has still not had a female president. But the fact that her campaign was taken seriously, at least initially at the time, was, I think, again, speaks volumes about the level of fame that these women were able to command at the time. And although she was unsuccessful, she was someone who was discussed quite seriously initially in the press. But as you say, as you mentioned before, she also got a lot of pushback. I mean, she was a very controversial figure in many ways. People felt that she was quite a scandalous figure. Many of the things that were leveled against her were perhaps unfair, but she was quite a flamboyant character. She was happy to court publicity. So I think that also plays into people's fascination with her and their criticism of her too.
This is a convergence of politics and spectacle. I mean, I'm thinking right now of Ronald Reagan, an actor. I'm thinking of Arnold Schwarzenegger, an actor. I'm thinking of Donald Trump, The Apprentice, you know. The idea that you can put on a spectacle as a performer and then migrate into the political sphere. Is this the same sort of phenomenon that you're describing, but it's with women in the Victorian age?
Well, I mean, I think many of these women were clearly extremely talented at publicity, but they also were talented at public speaking, which is obviously something else, you know, that you tend to need if you want to go into politics. They were often very opinionated as well. So I think, you know, we shouldn't underestimate the talents and the intelligence of these women. But yes, I think, you know, spectacle was clearly a part of it, and performance, certainly. All of the women that I write about in this book, there were certainly, to different degrees, levels of performance to what they were doing.
I want to go to Britain now and talk about Weldon, Georgina, Georgina. I don't know what your preference is. Georgina Weldon?
Georgina, yes. So she was a slightly different character from the others in the book. She was from quite a wealthy background, which immediately singled her out from the others. She could have quite easily just had a quiet life as a leisured Victorian lady moving in relatively aristocratic circles. She's also not someone who initially sought to make money as a medium in the way that the other women in the book did. But she became famous because, she was an active spiritualist participant, you might call her. She liked going to seances. It was part of her social life. She was quite an eccentric character anyway. I mean, some of the things that people would have felt were eccentric about her at the time would not seem that odd now. But for instance, she cut her hair quite short. She was a vegetarian. Clearly, these things are not in any way controversial now, but they were seen as quite eyebrow raising at the time. So in a way, the spiritualism perhaps went along with that. But she became well known because her husband tried to get her put away in an asylum. really various motivations on his part, but the key one was that he had fallen in love with another woman who he wanted to have a relationship with, he was already involved with, and really wanted his wife to be out of the way. They were already living apart from each other, but they were clearly still, you know, there was this link between them because they were still legally married. And one of the ways that he convinced a number of doctors to go along with this and to attempt to take Georgina into custody and have her put into an asylum was the fact that she was a spiritualist. And, you know, one of the doctors in particular really felt that this was a sign of madness. The plot failed. Georgina managed to evade capture, as it were. And then she took quite a public revenge against her husband, you know, by dragging what had happened to her into the press at the time. And she became quite a sort of celebrity, partly because she sort of turned from focusing on her own case to campaigning more widely for reformation of the lunacy laws, as they were called in Britain, you know, so trying to make it more difficult for people to be taken into an asylum on flimsy evidence. But also she was clearly, you know, someone who was very much admired within the spiritualist movement because she brought their cause into the public eye in quite a dramatic way.
When you say a dramatic way, isn't there a scene eventually where in the court there are spectators who cheer her when she wins her case?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, this was another thing. What she eventually, first of all, she tried to bring what had happened to her, like, into the court of public opinion. But eventually, due to various legal changes in Britain at the time, she was able to bring legal action against both her husband and the various doctors who'd colluded against her. And what was quite interesting was that she decided to pursue this legal action, but also to represent herself in court. And as we've said already, you know, a woman speaking in public in Victorian times was quite a novel thing. So, you know, a woman representing herself in court was clearly something that would generate huge amounts of coverage, both in the press, but also, you know, members of the public would really queue up and be fighting to get places in the public gallery to see what was going on. And yes, her performances were always quite flamboyant. She'd often bring lots of laughter into the courtroom, you know, not something we'd normally associate with legal action. And so she became quite a press favourite because of this, because she, for a time, she was engaged in a number of these court battles, and they always made, you know, very good copy for journalists.
So is this one of the more flamboyant facets of the women's suffrage movement? Is that too much to say? I mean, this was not necessarily first and foremost an effort to gain rights for women, but the intersection's clear. And I'm just wondering if the flamboyant presentation, the spectacle of it all, I wonder if that was a boon or a burden to somebody like Susan B. Anthony.
Yes. So particularly if you think about someone like Victoria Woodhull, initially she was quite embraced by the women's suffrage movement in the United States, because obviously, you know, she was doing these quite remarkable things for a woman of the time. You know, she was someone who admired is perhaps not quite the right word, but she certainly was someone of interest to very prominent female suffrage campaigners of the time. And for a while, a number of them were working together with Woodhull. But eventually, I think Woodhull was someone who kind of liked to have the attention on her quite a lot of the time. And in addition to that, there were various sort of political points on which they diverged. So eventually, sadly for Woodhull, by the time she was running for the US presidency, at a time when you would have actually really wanted, you know, individuals who are really prominent in the American women's suffrage movement to get behind you, most of them, not all, but many of them had actually deserted her. And so she ended up standing rather alone. So you're still speaking for women's rights, but outside of the more official suffrage movement of the time, which I think did end up harming her cause quite a lot.
Finally, the word visionary, it's in your subtitle, Six Visionary Victorian Women. Is there a nuanced understanding of visionary there? At least it has two meanings. Visionary meaning they're having trances, they're having dreams, they're channeling the dead, but also insightful, people with some kind of perspicacity towards the future, you know?
Yes, I think so. And I think actually, you know, that there's many things that these women said that perhaps these days we many people would look back on and think, oh, you know, that's rather amusing, perhaps, or, you know, I don't really agree with that. But there were lots of things that they said, either it's public speeches or wrote down, you know, in published works of the time, that actually have been ideas that have come to be taken seriously in the decades and that have passed since then. So I think, you know, you really can see them as quite influential on the journey towards, you know, greater female emancipation, but in quite an unusual way, perhaps.
Well, such interesting stories, a remarkable period of history, dynamic things going on. And I just love the idea that you would see the intersection between spiritualism and these women seeking a public voice and the women's emancipation. It's great, great volume. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Emily Midorikawa with us. Her book is titled Out of the Shadows, Six Visionary Victorian Women in Search of a Public Voice.
That was Marcus Smith. I'm Tannery Taylor. We just heard a bit about that scandalous 19th century business of husbands tossing wives into insane asylums. Well, we'll meet one of the victims who fought back. That's coming up next on Constant Wonder. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Tannery Taylor. It's the year 1860, and Elizabeth Packard is arrested and thrown into an insane asylum. Turns out, her husband didn't like her questioning his authority in public. In those days, husbands could toss their wives into asylums for all kinds of reasons. But Elizabeth didn't go quietly. She fought back. To get the story, Marcus Smith spoke with Kate Moore. She's the author of The Woman They Could Not Silence, One Woman, Her Incredible Fight for Freedom, and The Men Who Tried to Make Her Disappear.
Elizabeth's sort of downfall and her salvation, it's true to say, was essentially that she had a mind of her own. So yes, she decided to break away from her husband's spiritual teachings. Initially, she goes and worships with the Methodists instead. But simply the fact that she was questioning him and, you know, pursuing her own research into theology and, you know, essentially conducting her own personal relationship with God. When she prayed to him, you know, God was someone with whom Elizabeth felt she had a personal relationship. She didn't need to channel that through her husband. But her husband was outraged by this. And that is part of the reason why he sends her away. You know, and it's true to say as well, obviously, because he was a preacher, Elizabeth leaving his church was a very public rejection of him. And I think that sort of bruised ego also fed into this desire to send his wife away to an insane asylum.
So he has a congregation and they're observing the collapse of this marriage and they're witnessing. I mean, he sees this as a public humiliation.
He does, completely. Yes, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So then it sounds like there were maybe factions within the congregation or at least within the community. There were varying voices and people siding with her, people siding against her.
Yes. Factions within the community is correct, because actually his parishioners side with the preacher initially, at least. They actually sign a petition saying that they believe Elizabeth is insane and should be, you know, committed to an asylum as speedily as it can be conveniently done. But when you actually hear what the parishioners have to say about why they think Elizabeth mad, you know, the evidence, the so-called evidence that they cite is things like, for example, she shouted at her husband because he had not cleaned the yard. You know, someone else said that her dislike for her husband was evidence of madness. You know, a third person said that because she contributed to the Bible classes that the church ran, he cited her incessant talking as evidence of madness. But as we can see, all these reasons are just further evidence of a woman who was simply pushing boundaries. You know, a woman who, yes, she was married to her husband, but you know, her husband wasn't the dearest creature of her heart. You know, there was tension in the marriage. But the fact Elizabeth articulated it, the fact she would have the audacity to shout at her husband, this was seen by the parishioners as madness. The flip side of the coin are the other people in the community who say they've never seen a sign of Elizabeth being mad, that they think her treatment at the hands of her husband is cruel, that they're shocked by what is, you know, is going on. And yeah, the two sides are pitted against each other, with Elizabeth, you know, caught in the throes of this legal dilemma where her husband has the authority to send her away, no matter what, you know, whether the community is for or against it. Her husband has that power over her.
And I do want to talk a little bit more about that legal situation in those days, mm-hmm. where the husbands had that prerogative to, but there were children in this marriage as well.
That's right. Yes, Elizabeth is a mother of six, and actually, at the point she is sent to the asylum, the youngest is only 18 months old. You know, she's only recently weaned him from the breast. Her eldest is 18 years old, and so yes, there are children involved, and that is, you know, another reason that Theophilus cites for sending Elizabeth away. He thinks her influence over the children, you know, is scandalous because she's teaching them that they're not necessarily damned, you know, from birth. And so he is, you know, has even more motivation to try and shut her up and to send her away.
Now, he's a hellfire and damnation type preacher. I mean, there's mm-hmm. this is a stock character, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is. Although, as I say, having read Theophilus's diary, he really is a sort of law unto himself. You know, he's just, he is quite the character.
And she expressed in her writings that she did not want her children to be told over and over and over again that they were damned souls unless they, I don't know, complied with his expectations?
Well, complied with his expectations and, you know, followed his teachings. As you say, he was a hellfire and damnation type preacher. Well, he would lecture his children, you know, from the moment they came into the world, basically. You know, there are accounts from both the Packards of him making the children cry. You know, you've sort of got a five-year-old, you know, howling with despair that he's going to be burned alive and sent to hell. And Elizabeth was very concerned about this impact on her children. She wanted to teach some personal responsibility as well. That they did have the power to change their lives, and that they did have, you know, the power to decide whether they were going to be good or bad. And, you know, that was kind of on them as well. So there was a real split in the marriage, you know, along several fault lines, basically.
Talk about how she lands there in the asylum. This is quite the drama.
Well, it really is the drama. So Elizabeth is concerned by her husband's threat because he says to her, you know, he literally uses it as leverage. You know, if you don't conform, if you don't do what I say, I will send you to the asylum. So she has forewarning and she's worried about it. She actually seeks legal advice and she is told, don't worry about it. You know, you will get a jury before a six-man, you know, a trial before a six-man jury before you'll be sent to an asylum. That is the law of Illinois. And so Elizabeth relaxes a little bit. But then on the 18th of June, 1860, she wakes, you know, first thing in the morning, and she sees a group of men coming to her door. She's frightened, you know, this threat of her husband's is in the back of her mind and she doesn't know what's happening. She locks the door to her bedroom. The handle rattles. They're trying to get in. The next thing she hears as she's quickly throwing on clothes, trying to get dressed in the morning, is she sees and hears the gleam of an axe as it hacks its way into her bedroom. And these men seize her. They put her on the train to Jacksonville, Illinois. And that summer's night, she is committed to the insane asylum. And she protests. She says, you know, what about my trial? You know, she's actually been mentally preparing for a trial. But her husband reveals that actually the law does not apply to married women. Married women can essentially be treated exactly as their husbands want to treat them. The law was that wives could be sent away to asylums by request of the husbands, and specifically without the evidence of insanity required in other cases. That was the law in Illinois at that time, and it was also the law in other states as well. And so husbands literally had the power, if they had an unsatisfactory wife, to dispatch her to an asylum and the doctors would accept her. And in Elizabeth's case, you mentioned religious excitement earlier, but actually she wasn't admitted as a case of religious excitement. She was admitted for excessive application of body and mind, or as she put it, she'd been placed there by her husband for thinking.
Take 1860, that year, and compare it to the beginning of the Civil War. And when we talk about human rights, you know, so many of the narratives that we hear from this time period do focus on issues of race. Sometimes I wonder if the issue here of this brutal sexism doesn't somehow fall in the shadow of the other stories. You know, I'm not trying to compare them, but I mean, these are concurrent.
Yes, they are concurrent. And, you know, Elizabeth did see parallels as well, you know, in the sort of fight for freedom and emancipation. Because, you know, it's not just, the laws are not just set up so husbands can send their wives to asylums. Husbands had complete power over their wives. You know, they had power over their, you know, their wives' earnings. You know, a woman couldn't even keep her own earnings if her husband wanted to seize them. She had no custody of her children, no right to property. So it really was, a husband had complete power. It was a law known as coverture, which was actually inherited from England. So it seems we Brits have a lot to answer for. But you're right, you know, these sort of themes of fighting for freedom were running concurrently. And it is a parallel that I sort of sketch in the book as well, you know, as that fight for the sort of national, on the national stage is happening, Elizabeth is fighting a very private battle, really, you know, in the shadow of this hulking insane asylum, trying to get out and trying to win back her own life, really, the power to live her life as she herself wants to do it, and to, you know, find what essentially is this unsilenceable voice. You know, that the book is actually the journey not only of Elizabeth being locked up and fighting for her freedom, it's also the story of a woman, you know, discovering through the fire of adversity, you know, how to use her voice, you know, what it is she wants to say. And in Elizabeth's case, she decides that actually the private battle that she's fighting isn't enough. She writes, "I don't want another sister in America to suffer as I have." And so she ultimately decides to use her newly found voice to fight for the freedoms of all women in America. And that's partly why I wanted to write about her as well, because she's left this extraordinary legacy behind.
She's then in this institution for 3 years, I believe. And then during that time period, what does she experience? What is her communication to the outside world? How does she describe it all?
Well, it's a horrendous situation. Basically, the asylum is an incredibly cruel place. It's an abusive place. Elizabeth witnesses, you know, some of the most horrifying abuse that you can imagine. And she decides that she is not going to be a silent listener, a silent witness to it. She's going to record it, and she decides to keep a secret journal. She's not allowed to write, you know, she's not even allowed that voice on paper, but she steals scraps of fabric and, you know, rips out the margins of newspapers, and she keeps this secret journal for 3 years of everything that's going on. And the asylum is really just as you would imagine, you know, the horror of a 19th century asylum to be. You know, the attendants are straight out of that Gothic horror literature that I mentioned, you know, earlier in the interview, but this is all real. And I think that's one of the most horrifying things about the woman they could not silence, is that everything in it is real. But as I say, the inspiring thing about it is that despite the horrors that Elizabeth Packard encounters, she decides she is going to combat them. And so it is actually an inspirational story of a woman finding her voice and using it to change the world.
So is this the institution where at night they're deprived of their clothing so they can't escape through a window? Or is it, maybe I'm getting the wrong story.
No. That is correct. So yes, the women were not allowed to have their own clothes in their own rooms to prevent these sort of midnight flits. And everything was monitored. You know, the women had no freedom to do as they wished to do. You know, everything was prescribed. They couldn't stay in their bedrooms, lie on their beds. Their menstrual cycles are monitored. Some women have their hair shorn off when they arrive at the asylum. There is complete control over them. And actually, the doctor in charge of the institution, Dr. Andrew McFarland, you know, he writes that his ideal therapy is that the women learn to discover that he is their superior, as he puts it. He wants them to learn to, you know, become elevated by his smile and to bow at his reproof. And he says he wants to have control over the clothes that they wear, the food that they eat, even the very thoughts that they think. And there's this sort of, you know, process of indoctrination. It's this, what Elizabeth calls a subduing treatment, where the women are supposed to learn to behave, you know, to submit to this masculine authority. And that's the only way they're supposed to be allowed out and allowed home.
How is she eventually allowed out?
Well, as I say, this is the woman they could not silence. You know, the title is very true. And so there are lots of twists and turns to the story. But ultimately, Elizabeth is released, as her doctor put it, because she'd become a source of unendurable annoyance. Because Elizabeth Packard is, you know, she's described as having an irresistible magnetism, and she essentially attracts everyone around her, both patients and staff. And, you know, she teaches the patients, no, you know, don't listen to this guy telling you that you have to submit. Believe in yourself. Be true to yourself. You know, reject what he's telling you if you don't feel it's the right thing for you. And so she fires the patients up, basically, and there's, you know, revolution and resistance. And as I say, ultimately, she causes so much trouble in the asylum. She's so inspirational and, you know, she's leading everyone in this charge against the abuse that they're suffering and so on, that eventually she is released back into the world, where she becomes a source of unendurable annoyance to politicians and other people as she strives to change the world and succeeds in improving the rights of women and the mentally ill.
She writes a book, The Great Drama, I think it's called.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. And this is, again, part of the reason I wanted to write about her, because it is this journey of a woman, you know, a woman becoming a writer, a woman finding her voice. And I've been able to draw on Elizabeth's writings in writing The Woman They Could Not Silence. So if you read the book, you know, you will hear from her husband, because I've quoted from his diary too. But you also hear from Elizabeth Packard herself. She tells us in her own words exactly what it was like to be a sane woman sent away to an insane asylum. And we walk that journey with her. We walk in step with her. And she is able to bring it to life for us. You know, this, that she draws on the journal that she wrote in the asylum. She's, you know, she wrote The Great Drama in the asylum as well. And she wrote many other books besides. And so I've been able to draw on them to bring her world and herself to life in the book. And I think it's really special, actually, that she can use her own words to tell her own story. And I've been able to, you know, craft them into my narrative, so that I hope Elizabeth, you know, steps from the page into the reader's minds, you know, full of vibrancy and life, telling us exactly how it is.
She regains custody of her children. She ends up being an independent voice. Does she ally herself then with other movements of the day? Does she then somehow become a suffragist who is, you know, a card-carrying member? Or I'm just wondering if, to what extent she's her own person, you know, with a parallel cause, or if she becomes sort of institutional aligned with, you know, the committees and the and going to the conferences, and that's sort of a suffragist.
Yeah, well, I think as Elizabeth always did, she, you know, forges her own path and fights her own battles, actually. And you're right, you know, this is a story with a happy ending. You know, it's not just inspirational because of the woman that Elizabeth becomes and that journey that she goes on. It's also inspirational because it does have a happy ending. And that was something that was important to me as well when I was choosing my subject. I wanted to find a book and a story and an individual that did actually have that happy upside. And Elizabeth, I think, is a really interesting person in terms of her revolutionary efforts, because she was a very pragmatic and practical woman. I think because the causes for which she was fighting affected her personally, she was determined to affect change that would, you know, that she would see in her own lifetime. So actually, she wasn't officially a fully card-carrying suffragist, because Elizabeth developed a very clever way of making that argument with politicians. You can see in her early work and the work that she writes in the asylum that she did believe women should have the vote, and she believed in, you know, a female president. But actually, she doesn't, when she gets back out into the world and she is politically campaigning on the ground, she doesn't push that narrative. You know, she instinctively senses that that is too much too soon for a woman in the 1860s to do. And of course, she's absolutely right, given how long it actually took for women to win the vote. What Elizabeth Packard says is, you know, you need to change the laws to protect women. You need to change the laws so, for example, a husband cannot send his wife away to an asylum by request. You know, a woman needs protections in laws. And she says, if you don't change these laws to protect us, well, then perhaps we should have the vote. And so she sort of almost uses female suffrage as a sort of scare tactic to scare the male politicians into doing what she wants them to do, which I think, as I say, is actually quite a clever way of campaigning. You know, she appreciates she's not going to see that bigger change, and she actually uses it to manipulate the politicians into doing what she wants them to do.
Kate Moore is the author of The Woman They Could Not Silence, One Woman, Her Incredible Fight for Freedom, and The Men Who Tried to Make Her Disappear. Speaking of insane asylum reform, up next on Constant Wonder, we'll follow in the tracks of Nellie Bly, a 19th century female journalist who was already famous for undercover work in asylums when she set out to beat Jules Verne's fictional record of traveling around the world in 80 days. We'll follow in her tracks. Up next on Constant Wonder.